Does modernity equal progress? Not necessarily. Historian and author Graham Robb did extensive research into the gay culture of the 19th century and found a surprising thing. Tolerance. He wrote about it in his book Strangers. Robb told Steve Paulson that although there was tolerance for homosexuals in the 19th century, being gay publicly was another matter.
There was really only one person who was a German journalist in 1867, and he had published pamphlets saying that the third sex, as he put it, should be recognized as a separate legal civil category. And he went to the Conference of German Jurists in Munich in 1867 and more or less directly proclaimed that he was homosexual, or the word he used was Uranian. But apart from him, there's almost no example of anyone who publicly came out.
That was a pretty brave thing for him to do.
Yeah, he's the real hero, although, interestingly, not a martyr. I mean, there were people who tried to stop him speaking, and the chair of the meeting said, well, okay, you can continue so long as you do so in Latin. But he didn't run away after the speech. He went to the closing banquet in the Glass Palace in Munich, and a lot of people came up to him and congratulated him and said, what a courageous thing to do, and I'm like that too, and so on. But the unfortunate thing is that there were no further examples of that, really, until well into the 20th century.
Now, you've said that there often were laws on the books prosecuting gay people, but I guess most often they were not enforced. And now, the most famous case, of course, is Oscar Wilde's court case. So was that more the exception than the rule?
Yeah, Oscar Wilde is a huge distraction in gay history. The problem is that he's an obvious martyr to choose, a martyr to gay rights. But his trial was exceptional in so many ways, and really it's, in some ways, it wasn't a trial about sodomy at all. You know, Wilde was Irish, for one thing. He wasn't English, and he'd made a brilliant career out of poking fun at the English establishment. And a lot of the remarks that were made in the trial had more to do with snobbishness than with homophobia. I mean, according to the judge, one of his worst crimes had been that he'd taken a working-class boy and put a public school tie on him, which was an unforgivable blurring of social barriers. So, you know, sodomy was really just the pretext for the trial of Oscar Wilde.
Well, that's interesting. You're kind of rewriting gay history here, because usually Oscar Wilde is cited as this great martyr, and that this was kind of a pivotal moment in gay history.
Yeah, it's become a pivotal moment in gay history, but it's not at all representative. I mean, it's a kind of what sociologists call minstrelization, that if the gay person is sufficiently flamboyant and amusing and a good enough entertainer, then he'll be forgiven his foibles. And there's a lot of that in Oscar Wilde. You know, if you happen not to be like Oscar Wilde, but you're gay, and yet people somehow expect you to have traits that are associated with Oscar Wilde, it's quite a dilemma to be in. And really, there are plenty of other martyrs apart from Oscar Wilde, you know, more obscure so-called ordinary people who suffered just as much as Oscar Wilde and who were persecuted for their sexuality.
Now, one thing that you do is you go through a lot of the literature of the 19th century and the famous writers, Stendhal, Balzac, Gogol, Strindberg, and they often alluded to homosexual love in their novels, in their letters. They may not have been gay themselves, but clearly this subject figured into the consciousness of people at that time.
Yeah, it was certainly, you know, the confusing thing is that I think nowadays we tend to think of a novelist, for example, as someone who can write about anything in society. There are no barriers to the subjects you can treat in novel. But in the 19th century, there were fairly strict conventions about the subjects that you could treat. So homosexuality doesn't tend to appear directly, and you have to look for it and detect it in indirect ways. But, you know, for a modern historian, that's also a problem, because the people who did write about it are so exceptional that it's difficult to present them as somehow typical of their age, because they certainly weren't. I mean, Dickens is a good example, because at first sight, he doesn't mention homosexuality at all anywhere in his books, and yet he was certainly aware of it. And actually it does appear in his books, but in a very subtle way.
Can you give me an example?
Well, for example, in Our Mutual Friend, two young men have a very close relationship, and there are lots of hints that this is something more than the usual kind of relationship. But what happens to them is what happens to a lot of proto-gay couples in 19th century fiction, which is that one of them dies a lingering death. And so it's okay for them to almost consummate their love because one of them's dying. So if there was any sin or untowardness in it, he's paid the price. And it's interesting that even now, today, some gay novelists say they find it difficult to portray a happy gay relationship because that literary convention is so strong, you know, that it does have to end in death. And it's partly, of course, because of the AIDS epidemic, but there is also that literary aspect to it.
Now, we've, for the most part, been talking about men in this history, gay men. What about women? Is there a different history when it comes to 19th century lesbians?
Well, the big difference is really that there's much less history of people who were obviously lesbian. I mean, for one thing, men had, on the whole, broader social lives. They tended to control the family finances. It was easier for them to travel and so on. So there's much less information about lesbian life in the 19th century, but it is there. You have to extrapolate to some extent from a few examples. But one woman from England, for example, who knew she was lesbian and always considered it something perfectly natural, went to Paris and immediately met lots of other women like herself from different walks of life. And so that's quite interesting. And it does show that there was also a lesbian life in some parts of Europe.
Was there also a lesbian underground culture, bars and that kind of thing?
There was an underground lesbian culture in certain cities. I mean, it's difficult to be categorical about it because we're just too ignorant of the subject. But in Paris, there was a whole area which, after 10 o'clock in the evening, was known to be a lesbian area, and there'd be bars and clubs, hotels where lesbian women could meet. You know, the problem is that people who then wanted to campaign for lesbian rights found it difficult because there was this association of homosexual activity with the underworld and dark parts of cities and prostitution and so on. But, you know, where else would you go to meet like-minded people?
We've talked about writers, and near the end of your book, you have some rather interesting comments about certain well-known detective heroes. You say, for instance, that everybody knows instinctively that Sherlock Holmes is homosexual. That may be news to some people, but...
it's instinctive knowledge. The biggest surprises all come from what's already in your brain. If you think, for example, of film adaptations of the Sherlock Holmes stories, the most successful ones are always ones that emphasize that wonderful, tense passion that Watson and Holmes have for each other. And if a woman is brought in, if there's a traditional love interest, it tends to go a bit limp and unconvincing. I mean, think about Billy Wilder, for example, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which was billed as a love story between two men, half jokingly. I mean, that film worked brilliantly until the conventional love interest came in. And Wilder himself said, you know, it's obvious that Holmes and Watson, this is a description of a gay couple, and he wished that he'd been much more upfront about it, but he was forced to work with the son of Conan Doyle. But Conan Doyle himself, as a doctor, was very interested in homosexuality. He was a great admirer of Oscar Wilde, and there's a lot of Oscar Wilde in Sherlock Holmes. And as he went on, I think like a lot of writers of detective fiction, he began to parody his own character, and so he becomes more and more cheeky as the years went by. So in the end, you see Sherlock Holmes and Watson sitting together in the Turkish baths in London in Northumberland Avenue. And there are all kinds of hints. If you put all of Sherlock Holmes' readings together, they all have homosexuality as their common denominator.
So you're saying Doyle had a certain camp aesthetic?
Yeah, it's definitely camp. You know, if you think of Sherlock Holmes, in fact, was created on the stage by an American actor who was very camp, and he was almost certainly gay himself. And when Conan Doyle saw him for the first time, he said, yes, that's it, he's Sherlock Holmes. But what really interested me was the way that theme persists in all those detective, nearly all those detective partnerships. There very often is some sexual oddity. Lord Peter Wimsey, Hercule Poirot, Batman and Robin, right the way back to Edgar Allan Poe. You know, there is at least an unconscious connection between those uncanny powers of detection and the kind of sexual oddity.
It sounds like you're also saying that there's something in the genre of detective stories that lends itself to dealing with this subject, because detectives are uncovering secrets. And, of course, homosexuality was the great unmentionable. The two would naturally go together.
Yes, exactly. And the gay man is the man who knows how to lead a double life, who understands these dark parts of the city that respectable people don't go to, and who consorts with criminals as well as respectable people. So that, on the one hand, there's that social element. And a lot of gay men at the time did compare themselves to amateur detectives because of the sort of double life they had to lead. But there also seems to be an archetypal theme running through it. North American Indian tribes had transvestite figures who were detectives. You know, they were mocked, but they were also considered to have special insights. So it's very interesting to see that expressing itself in modern fiction in quite a humorous but very persistent form.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much. This has been extremely interesting.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Graham Robb is the author of Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century. He spoke with Steve Paulson.